Welcome to episode 2 of Irregular Climate, your semi-irregular podcast looking at the irregular climate in our atmosphere and the irrational climate of global warming denialism. I am Dan Mutal. This week, more skepticism versus denialism, attribution, denialism in the Chicago Tribune, and the skeptic debunk of the week. First up, errata. Linsden's op-eds were not published in the Washington Post, as I mentioned last week in the podcast. Rather, they were published in the Wall Street Journal. This doesn't excuse the Washington Post, as they have published some notoriously bad op-eds by George Will in the past, but they haven't published Linsden's op-eds. Last week, a listener asked me about the open letter signed by 255 members of the National Academy of Sciences, condemning the political attacks against climate science that have intensified of late. I mentioned that I didn't think this was a direct response to Virginia Attorney General Cuccinelli's suit against Michael Mann, since the suit was announced shortly after the letter was published. But I was only speculating, so I asked the author of the letter, Peter Glick, and this is his response. The letter was written long before Cuccinelli in March. I spent the end of March and much of April collecting and verifying signatures, and at the end of April, we sent it to publications for release, and Science agreed to publish it. Cuccinelli came after the letter was written and all the signatures gathered, but it is precisely the kind of attack the letter addressed. So there you have it. This letter wasn't directly a response to Cuccinelli's suit against Mann, but this type of political attack against science is exactly what the letter was meant to address. Okay, that's it for errata. I'd like to move on now to back again, just like last week, to denialism versus skepticism, because there is a difference, it is important, and it's confusing, especially in practice. New Scientist actually did a whole issue on denialism, and it's filled with good articles. I recommend all of you pick it up and read it. But there's a few articles I'd like to highlight. The first one is titled, Why Sensible People Reject the Truth, and this is a quote from it. Whatever they are denying, denial movements have much in common with one another, not least the use of similar tactics. All set themselves up as courageous underdogs, fighting a corrupt elite engaged in a conspiracy to suppress the truth or foist a malicious lie on ordinary people. This conspiracy is usually claimed to be promoting a sinister agenda, the nanny state, take over the world economy, government power over individual, financial gain, atheism. All denialisms appear to be attempts like this to regain a sense of agency over uncaring nature. Does that sound familiar? Sounds exactly like global warming denialists, unsurprisingly. It's all a sinister plot by socialist world government trying to take over the world, or something like that. That's pretty normal. But what has changed, especially with global warming denialism, is the corporate influence of this. There is another article in this titled How Corporations Manufacture Doubt, and that's actually written by one of the contributors to the DSmog blog, which is an excellent blog that, again, all you guys should check out. But the key point of that article is that the doubt industry has ballooned in the past two decades. There are now tons of think tanks publishing dubious and confusing policy positions, dozens of phony grassroots, sometimes known as AstroTurf organizations, created to make those positions appear to have legitimate following. There's a huge echo chamber built up that pretty much takes any ridiculous position and makes it seem legitimate. It's dishonest. It should be exposed for what it is. You don't want to mistake phony grassroots organizations for real grassroots organizations, because they are completely different. But it's a technique that's been used a lot in recent years specifically by the global warming denial machine. And finally, there's a great article by Michael Shermer that deals directly with denialism versus skepticism, called When a Skeptic Isn't a Skeptic. And he starts out saying, what's the difference between a skeptic and a denier? When I call myself a skeptic, I mean that I take a scientific approach to the evaluation of claims. A climate skeptic, for example, examines specific claims one by one, carefully considers the evidence for each, and is willing to follow the facts wherever they lead. A climate denier has a position staked out in advance and sorts through the data, employing confirmation bias, the tendency to look for and find confirmatory evidence for pre-existing beliefs, and ignores or dismisses the rest. Skepticism is integral to the scientific process because most claims turn out to be false. Weeding out the few kernels of wheat from the large pile of chaff requires extensive observation, careful experimentations, and cautious inference. Science is skepticism, and good scientists are skeptical. Denial is different. It is the automatic naysaying of a claim regardless of the evidence for it. Sometimes, even in the teeth of evidence, denialism is typically driven by ideology or religious belief, where the commitment to that belief takes precedence over the evidence. Belief comes first, reasons for belief follow, and those reasons are window to ensure that the belief survives intact. It's an interesting statement, and I agree with it, but it's interesting because Michael Shermer himself used to be a climate change denier. It wasn't until 2006 that he wrote an article where he finally mostly accepted climate science. And I'd like to read a quote from Mark from the Denialism blog, who sums up the situation quite nicely. It goes like this. While I think it's wonderful that Michael Shermer, has come around 40 years after the science, I still think he has to own up to the fact that his rejection of the science, perfectly strong science, in the 90s and 2000s, was due to anything but his ideology. There wasn't a new piece of data that arrived in 2006 to change him. Just according to him, Al Gore's presentation that finally worked to change him. Why would a true skeptic reject the science and the scientists and the IPCC only to convert after seeing the vice president give a talk at TED? I think it likely was easy to be skeptic given his distaste for the environmental movement and the perceived infringement on individual liberties that environmental regulation entails. It is also still questionable if his support for Lomborg and other libertarian minimizers doesn't represent that he has just morphed his denial into a new strategy that admits the science is real, then happily undermines any of its significance. And that really signifies the Lomborg strategy. Lomborg says he accepts the science, but he minimalizes any cost, any of the costs associated with that science, but at the same time, massively inflating the cost of action. So he reduces the cost of inaction, increases the cost of action, and then makes it seem like, well, obviously we should do nothing. That's the sensible thing to do. And it's a problem because a lot of people fall for that trap. But it's wrong. Recently, there was a very extensive documentation of Lomborg's dishonesty done by Thomas Lovejoy, published in his book called The Lomborg Deception. It's worth a read. It pretty much goes one by one the sources of Lomborg uses and shows why they're false. I'm not going to do the whole thing right now. It's a great book. It's worth a read. If anyone still has any doubt that Lomborg's view of the science, even though he says he accepts it, it's still denialism for the most part. This really highlights a difficulty in determining the difference between skeptics and deniers. Is Shermer a denier or a skeptic? Well, it's hard to tell, and I don't really follow him that closely, so I don't want to say specifically, but a skeptic doesn't undermine the significance of the science of global warming. It doesn't automatically reject the estimates that say the costs of inaction for global warming are unimaginably high. It doesn't reject that. It accepts them and evaluates them, and at the same time, it doesn't overly inflate the cost of action. I'll leave it at that because, again, as I mentioned, I don't follow him closely enough to conclude one way or the other. But it does this does highlight the fact that even smart, well-educated people can fall into the trap of denialism. No one is immune to denialism, and somewhere or another, we all probably exhibit some form of it. Here's another quote from Mark of the Denialism blog. "We're not shutting down debate or censoring anyone, or even insinuating moral deficiency. Quite the opposite. We're showing how even well-meaning, smart people fall for irrational arguments and try to describe which arguments aren't worth listening to or accepting as legitimate. Denialism is not actual healthy debate. It's the art of creating the appearance of debate when the facts are settled. Recognizing denialism is just recognizing that some tactics are flawed and their use does not represent actual healthy debate. Clearly, some denialists aren't honest brokers in debate, but the fact is a lot of people fall for and use these arguments simply because they don't know any better. And until everyone understands what represents healthy debate and logical arguments, progress will be made, or little progress will be made in advancing legitimate scientific views against nonsense being peddled." But this raises a question. How do we know the warming is caused by humans? Scientists call this attribution. How can we attribute the warming we have seen to human emissions or something else? Real Climate, another great blog that is a worthwhile read, recently had a post on this, and they really highlighted the difference between attribution in a laboratory and attribution in a more observational science like climatology. In a laboratory, you can isolate the factor you want to find attribution for, and you can do repetition. You can't do that on the climate. We don't get to... we don't have another planet. We don't have a time machine. We're kind of running the experiment, and we got one shot at it. So how do you do attribution? Well, the main thing of it is you look at what you expect to happen if CO2 is causing emissions or is causing the warming, or if something like solar irradiance or aerosol or volcanoes or whatever. So there are actually, we expect the warming to be different depending, or cooling depending on the forcing, to be different. We expect the effects of these forcings to be different on the planet depending on how it works. For example, the big difference between solar forced changes to and CO2 or greenhouse gas force changes happens in the stratosphere. If it's solar, the stratosphere is supposed to warm, just like the lower atmosphere. But if it's driven by CO2, we actually expect the stratosphere to cool. So that's one way to do attribution. We look for stratospheric cooling, and we see, okay, it is cooling, and that's been confirmed. So now we know that, okay, solar is probably not it. Obviously, it's more complicated, quote, more complicated than this, but that's the basic gist of it. Every forcing has a different effect on the climate. You know, we're not just looking at global temperatures, those nice little graphs that you see everywhere. That is part of it, but we know a lot more about what's going on in the climate system than just global temperatures. So we can look at all the data and see sort of what CO2-driven warming would look like in all the data, not just temperatures. What solar-driven warming or cooling would look like in all the data. And then see on what we observe. Okay, we've observed CO2 rising, so that's good. And we've actually can look at the CO2 and determine what the source is. And it's us, or not us specific, but our cars, our power plants, our planes, and all of that stuff. And we know that we're increasing CO2, and we know that what we're seeing in the climate system is what we would expect from CO2-driven warming. It's not what we would expect from solar-driven warming or anything else. One of the best analogies I've heard, and I don't really remember where I first heard it, for this is a house. A house has many factors that can change the temperature inside the house. There's the central heating or air conditioning system, the stove or oven, the number of windows it has, if it's open, the temperature and weather outside, whether there's a fireplace, and more. All these things can change the temperature inside a house. So if we're inside the house and we're noticing that the temperature is changing, We need to ask some questions before we can determine why it's changing. Did someone turn the heating on? Did someone turn the air conditioning on? Are the windows opening? What's the temperature outside? Is it windy? Is it sunny? Is it snowing? Is the temperature, is someone cooking? Is the oven on or stove on? All those things will impact the temperature of the house. Once we have answered those questions, we can begin to look at why the house is warming. If we don't have an answer to the question, we can do some observation. We can place thermometers at different points in the house. And for example, if the heating is on, well, we'll notice warmer temperatures by the heating vents. So we can determine the signature of heating from the central heating system. If the windows are open, we can determine that by either measuring wind or placing temperature sensors, thermometers, by there. Well, the same holds true with climatology. The fact that the Earth has warmed was never enough for climatologists to say that it was our greenhouse gas emissions that were the cause of this warming. Good attribution was needed, and indeed the most recent IPCC report has a whole chapter devoted to attribution. It's chapter 9 from the first working group, for those who are interested. It's kind of long and kind of technical, but it is readable if you spend a little bit of time thinking about what is being said. Changing gears now, I want to focus on an article published in the Chicago Tribune by Dennis Byrne. It's an article reporting on the recent Heartland Conference in Chicago. Heartland is a think tank that, aside from denying global warming, also denies the health effects of tobacco smoke. So then this article is basically reporting on a conference they had in Chicago a couple weeks ago. There's a couple points he makes that I want to look at. First is that he cringes when someone says settled science. And he says that claims of settled science have such a tattered history of being wrong, you'd think global warming partisans would be afraid to trot out that old canard. But I want to know, if settled science is rare and mostly wrong, why do we keep doing science? Why, after hundreds of years, would we still be doing science? We want to learn about the world. Really, the goal of science is to become settled. We want to learn why something works and describe and know how it works, why it works, and know those things with certainty. Obviously, science can never give us 100% certainty, but it can get pretty close. And there is also a big difference between something being called settled science and so an entire field of science being settled and parts of a field being settled. For example, greenhouse gas emissions cause warming is settled. But that does not mean the entire field of climatology is settled. That's why we still have climatologists actively working and researching, because there's a lot of things in climatology that are not settled. As with any field of science, there are areas with high certainty that are settled and areas with low or no certainty that are not settled. This is normal. This is what we expect. The article goes on to state that we got another dose of settled science baloney a couple weeks ago when the National Research Council, an arm of the National Academy of Sciences, said the science underlining the assertions of man-made global warming is sound, despite ClimateGate discoveries that called into question the basic global warming's basic conclusions. Exactly what conclusions were called into question? I've actually asked this several times. I've never gotten a good response. It's not enough to say climate change has been debunked because of a few emails. So emails are never the proper way to debunk science. Bad science is countered with good science, not emails, especially stolen emails, and especially emails without proper context. But what science exactly has been disproved? At the Heartland Conference, we had Roy Spencer essentially defending Phil Jones of CREW, which is where the leaked emails came from, saying Phil Jones has been looking at the climate records for a very long time. Frankly, our data set agrees with his, so unless we are all making the same mistake, we're not likely to find out anything new from the data anyways. For those of you who don't know, Roy Spencer is a climate change denier or skeptic. He is a working climatologist, so Calling him a denier might be a little harsh, but he's definitely way out of mainstream climate science. Yet he is defending Phil Jones. I've asked several times exactly for people to tell me exactly what science has been overturned by the leaked emails, and got no response that stood up to any amount of scrutiny. Usually, just vague claims, which in science don't really cut it. And the three inquiries that have looked into this have also not found anything. So claiming that it's called that this is ClimateGate has called into question basic science is a flat out lie. It's his opinion. It's what he wants to be true, but it's not reality. He is lying to us. The article goes on and blames the National Research Council for advocating putting a price on carbon, which is something that all economists pretty much say that we need to do in order to reduce our emissions, or at least let the free market reduce our emissions. That's stepping into politics and blah, blah. It's basic economics. You put a price on something, you make it more expensive, demand for that good, whatever it is, goes down. For the scientific panel to be saying that, to be advocating that, is not real politics. It's basic economics. But the article goes even further, essentially stating that Phil Jones has admitted, shockingly, that there is no statistically significant warming since 1995. Now, this is true, but the way he phrases it betrays a complete lack of understanding or willful ignorance, or just lying, about what that statement actually means. This statement from Phil Jones comes from a BBC interview, and Phil Jones was asked, "Do you agree that from 1995 to the present, there has been no statistically significant warming?" And Phil Jones replies, "Yes, but only just. I have also calculated the trend for the period from 1995 to 2009. This trend, 0.12 Celsius per decade, is positive, but not statistically significant at this 95% significant level. The positive trend is quite close to the significant level. Achieving statistical significance in scientific terms is much more likely for longer periods and much less likely for shorter periods." Basically, what this means is that over short periods of time, even if you see a warming trend, it's not statistically significant. The warming trend is there, and we're still warming. The article, however, presents this as we are not warming. And since most readers don't know what statistical significance means, they will arrive at the wrong conclusion. The article then goes on to say that the vast majority of climate scientists don't agree the issue is settled. And that is actually attributed to Phil Jones. Now, I've looked at the BBC interview, and I have no idea what this is referring to. Nowhere in the interview does it say that. It seems to me that that's just a made-up fact, something that not true, but fits nicely with the point he's trying to make. Well, it's a lie. It's not true. It's the vast majority of scientists do think the issue of whether our greenhouse gas emissions are causing the atmosphere to warm is settled. A survey released last year showed that 97% of publishing climatologists say agree with that. Now, that's an overwhelming majority. Some might call that a consensus. So that statement is just a lie. The article, of course, mentions the errors found in the IPCC and treats them as, a major thing that, causes the entire edifice of global warming science to come crashing down. But just ask yourself this question. In a report that is 3,000 pages long, would you expect there to be some errors to make it through the review process? After all, the reviewers are not perfect. They are imperfect humans like the rest of us. The writers are not perfect. They are imperfect humans like the rest of us. It is only logical that some errors will make it through. It's a long report. A lot of people wrote it. Most of those people are unpaid volunteers. Obviously, errors make it through. The fact that errors make it through does not mean that everything in the report is wrong. And actually, the article seems to agree with this. He actually says, "You can argue that this doesn't disprove the existence of global warming, and you'd be right." So why bother write the article in the first place, then? Anyway, what's perhaps most amusing is it doesn't seem like the author has bothered to read the National Research Council or the IPCC reports that he spends a lot of time criticizing. He argues that they're arguing from authority instead of addressing the science itself. Well, if you spend even 1 minute reading these reports, you'd realize that they're not arguing from authority. They're arguing from the science. That's what their scientific reports. It's not really surprising, but they are arguing from the science. They don't talk, they don't say you should trust us because we are the IPCC or the National Research Council. No, they say this is the case. This is specifically the case for global warming. This is why we accept it. This is the evidence for it. This is the science behind it. But apparently the author doesn't know this. He goes on, says, well, it's, you know, they're arguing from authority. He compares himself to Galileo, as deniers like to do. But, I mean, really, this type of article should never be published in a reputable newspaper. It lies, it twists the truth, and it's just downright dishonest. It should not be published. The newspaper, the media, should be better than this. They should be filtering out this type of inaccurate reporting and telling the truth. As I said before, they're entitled to their own opinion, but not their own facts. This article thinks it is entitled to its own facts, and it isn't. There were, of course, more dishonesty at the Heartland Conference than was presented in this article. But that gives you an idea of the type of people and the type of reporting that people who are interested in global warming science have to deal with. Up next, we have a brand new segment, which is not surprising given that this is only the second episode, called Skeptic Debunk of the Week. It's done by John Cook, who runs the amazing Skeptical Science website.
When you look through the many arguments from global warming skeptics, a pattern emerges. They tend to focus on small pieces of the puzzle while neglecting the bigger picture. A good example of this is the argument that human CO2 emissions are tiny compared to natural emissions. The argument goes something like this. Humans emit CO2 by burning fossil fuels. Each year, we send around 29 billion tons of CO2 into the atmosphere. Natural emissions come from plants breathing out CO2 and dissolved CO2 outgassing from the ocean. When you add up all the natural emissions, it comes to 770 billion tons per year. So humans, 29 billion tons. Nature, 770 billion tons. Our contribution is tiny compared to nature. But this argument doesn't give you the full picture. What it fails to tell you is that nature doesn't just emit CO2, it also absorbs. Plants breathe in CO2. The oceans are a huge sink where CO2 dissolves into the water. How much does nature absorb every year? Just over 770 billion tons. Natural absorptions balance natural emissions. What we're doing is upsetting the balance. Because of human emissions, atmospheric CO2 is at its highest level in over 15 million years.
Come back next week where John Cook takes a look at another skeptical argument and demonstrates why it doesn't stand up. And finally, I'd like to have a quick note on why I haven't really talked about the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. First, it is being extensively covered everywhere else, it seems, and I don't feel the need to cover it here, especially when there are other more important stories that haven't gotten the level of attention I think they deserve. But also because I'm finding it very difficult to separate the wheat from the chaff. There's a lot of information out there, much of it contradictory, and I don't know what is real and what isn't. There is substantial uncertainty. Many aspects of this spill are unprecedented, which means that even the experts are confused. Quite understandably. But that leaves little room for me to do anything worthwhile with this story. Of course, if that changes, then I will say something about the BP oil spill. And I'd like to end on a positive note. A recent poll from Nanos on the upcoming G8 G20 meetings here in Canada revealed that Canadians rank global warming and economic recovery as the top two priorities for the meetings. But global warming actually beats economic recovery as the top response across nearly all categories of Canadians. This is unexpected. Most people place short-term gain over long-term well-being, so I would have expected economic recovery to come out on top of on top of global warming, but it didn't. It was global warming beat out economic recovery, which is really substantial. Well, that's it for this week's show. Thanks for listening. My name is Dan Wutall, and you can find me online at ofdan.ca. Show notes will be published soon and at the Irregular Climate website, irregularclimate.com. And until next week, try and stay regular.